Now let's talk about the evolution of banking rules. Last summer, Congress passed a bill to reform Wall Street, but did not spell out the specific regulations. Now some people are writing the new rules of banking, and Hannah Jaffe-Walt of our Planet Money team introduces us to some of them.
Three women walk into a large carpeted office with their sweaters, coffee, reading glasses, each carrying the book under an arm. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. They spread themselves out at a table, offer me coffee, laugh generously at my bad jokes. It feels a little bit like we're all sitting down for the weekly bank regulator book club.
That's why I laughed.
Okay, so if you just tell me your names and titles.
Roberta McInerney, Deputy General Counsel, FDIC.
Kimberly Coppa, Senior Counsel, FDIC.
Ruth Amberg, Senior Counsel, FDIC.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet your banking regulators. Three women tasked with taking the book in front of them, bank reform legislation, and making it come to life.
Yes, and we have tabs with the main provisions that we need to refer to really quickly.
The FDIC is responsible for writing 44 new banking rules inspired by this book. As Roberta shows me her multicolored tabs referring to key sections, Kimberly Coppa nods and holds up her incredibly tattered book.
My book is very worn. It basically falls open to where you need it to.
There are gatherings like this being held at bank regulator agencies across Washington, D.C. And here is why. Congress wrote legislation that says, among many other things, banks need to become safer by holding more capital. Well, how much capital is more capital? That is left up to the regulators. Or later, in Section 725, Congress says derivatives should be regulated. Which derivatives? And regulated how, exactly? This is why when the bill passed last summer, Roberta turned to Kimberly and said,
"Now the real work starts."
There's also a real sense of terror.
One of the biggest responsibilities handed to the FDIC is to make it so that banks aren't too big to fail, so the government doesn't have to bail them out. Congress wants the FDIC to be able to go in and take over and run enormous troubled banks, just as they do with smaller banks. So, today's book club conversation, if the FDIC does have to do this, where will the money come from to wind down one of those big giants? Roberta flips to Section 206 for discussion.
The FDIC, after 30 days, we can borrow an amount that's equal to 90% of the fair value of the total consolidated assets of each company that are available for repayment.
She stops here briefly for emphasis with raised eyebrows as if to indicate, well, obviously, here is where the interesting part is.
I mean, as a lawyer, this is probably maybe boring for me, but as a lawyer, well, what does the term fair value mean? The term fair value is not defined.
Discussion ensues. Does fair value mean market value? And what was the intended meaning of the word appropriate in the next section? It's around this point that the book club starts to feel a little bit more like Talmud study session. Details, yes, but you could argue that this is the part of the bank reform process that really matters. At least that's what the bank lobbyists seem to think.
Those folks, instead of focusing on Congress because the bill is passed, are now focusing on regulators.
This is Commissioner Bart Chilton, another regulator at the Commodities Futures and Exchange Commission.
We're having meetings like crazy. Folks are in talking with us about what they want. We are far outnumbered.
The women at the FDIC say they try to do their best to steer clear of undue influence as they write their 44 rules. And they say to do so, they try to stick to the book. Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're continuing our special look at family this hour. We started out by talking about family secrets, something we were thinking about after Oprah Winfrey announced that she had discovered the existence of a sister she had known anything about until a few months ago. In a few minutes, we'll talk more about just who Americans consider family and why, particularly whether they consider gay couples family. But first, we note that 1 out of 10 people living in the U.S. was born somewhere else, which means that many people have parents who might have very different ideas about how to be a parent than many of their friends' parents. They might be particularly strict, for example, in a way that many Americans are not used to. One such parent has been getting a lot of ink lately, Yale Law Professor Amy Chua, whose book Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother has become a bestseller. But hers is not the only story. For a couple of years now, Teresa Wu and Serena Wu have been cracking them themselves up and their friends and blog followers by passing around the wit and wisdom of their Chinese immigrant mothers. Their blog is called My Mom is a Fob, and that blog is now a book by the same name. It's subtitled Earnest Advice in Broken English from Your Asian American Mom. And Teresa Wu and Serena Wu are with us now. Interestingly enough, they're not related. Teresa is in our New York bureau, and Serena joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for having us.
Now, Teresa, I'm going to start with you. Fob means fresh off the boat. I thought that was a mean thing to say about somebody. Not so?
Fob used to be a derogatory term that people used to make fun of immigrants. But in my generation, at least, growing up, it was never used as a derogatory term. It was kind of a friendly, joking way of describing people who are half Asian, half American, you know, culturally not all American, but just half there. So.
And Serena, how did you two get the idea to start this blog?
Teresa and I, we've both been longtime bloggers, and we always post funny snippets from emails from our parents. And so then one night, Teresa was like, we should start a blog where users can submit their own stories, and we can make it like a compilation, sort of like an anthropology of all these fobby, cute tales from our parents on a blog together. So that's what we did.
Now, unfortunately, I cannot read some of the funnier entries because they are a little, how should we put it, double entendres, unintended double entendres, and quite innocently meant, but nevertheless, not for sharing at work. So why don't you give us just a couple of examples of some of the things that you think are particularly funny? Teresa?
One of my favorites is, this one's from my mom, she says, think when you little, you chase a squirrel. The squirrel will run fast away. But if you stop, the squirrel will stop too. He may also peek on what you're doing. Do not scare the squirrel. And that's like her idea of love advice to her daughter.
Do not. Oh, that was love advice. Okay, I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure what that was advice about. Feeding the squirrels. Okay, love advice. Okay, Serena, do you have one?
Yep. So this one's titled Dating Analogies. Never give anyone a free trial and take your product home. They must pay full amount first, because if they get free trial, I know because I sell cosmetics for many years, they will always return the product.
That's dating advice, too.
Yep.
Oh, okay. Now, you say in the book that you are not trying to make fun of your moms. You think they're freaking adorable, and you want to showcase those precious moments to a community of Asian American kids who know exactly what it's like to be on the receiving end of that amazing, unconditional, and sometimes misspelled love. One of the things that I was noticing about the blog and, of course, about the book is that it started off with a bang. I mean, like once people heard about it, people just kept sending you stuff. They all wanted to talk about it. Why do you think that is?
This is Teresa. I think that people just identified so much with it, and there hasn't really been a community online that's been like children of immigrant parents. So that was the first community that people mm-hmm. found online that they could relate to. And everybody just loved the idea so much that they wanted to jump in and contribute and be part of it and talk with other people who shared the same experiences.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Teresa and Serena Wu. They are the co-authors of the blog and the book, My Mom is a Fob. They're sharing the hilarious, adorable, and endearing antics of their Asian immigrant parents. Many times, I think maybe there's an image of people who are immigrants being really suspicious of other people outside of their community. And there was a mm-hmm. funny entry about enjoying some steaks that one of the moms has grilled on her new grill. Do you want to read that one? It's on page 156.
Me. Ma, these steaks are amazing. Mom. Yes, and my grill is so great because it drips excess oil while it's grilling the meat. Simple and easy to clean and keeps us healthier. I just love my Morgan Freeman grill. Brother. Ma, did you mean your George Foreman grill? Mom. You two always like to pick at my English. Their names are similar, okay? And they're both nice black men I see on TV.
Oh, no. I thought that was so funny. But one of the things that I thought was interesting, too, is that some of these funny things happen because your parents desperately want to stay connected to you and they want to be up to date. Does anybody want to talk about that?
I'll add to that. So this is Serena. So the funny thing about my mom is she likes to think that she's super techie and super hip and up to date with the latest technologies. So she's Facebook friends with me, although she has wall restrictions. She's also on Twitter, and a lot of times she'll tweet me messages assigning me homework, like you have to read an article every day and tell me what you learned. Or even she'll post on my Facebook and be like, oh, how did that book signing event go? So she really likes to connect with me online.
Teresa, what about you?
I think the funny thing about a lot of these stories is that on top of our moms, you know, not quite understanding our culture in terms of just like American culture, they also are technologically challenged. So they try to go on Facebook. They don't really understand what it's for. They make weird comments, like inappropriate comments on other people's, you know, your friends' pages. And like, there's one particular story that I thought was really funny. It's called Online Predators via YouTube. The girl writes, so my mom is a very protective mother. This is what happened after she watched a 60-minute special on online predators. While I'm watching a video blog on YouTube, mom says, who is that guy? I say, I don't know. Mom, why is he talking to you? Me, it's a video. Mom says to the computer, go away. My daughter don't want to meet up and talk to you. So clearly she does not get the concept of YouTube. And at the same time, it still demonstrates her like overprotective, overbearing Asian momness.
So do your parents, have your parents read the book? Have they read your blog? Or what do they think about it? Teresa?
So my mom has looked at the book. She slipped through it. I don't think she understands why most of the passages are funny. But she's proud, so I'm happy with that.
Okay. Serena, what about you? Have your parents checked the book out? What do they think?
Mom loves the blog and she loves the book. She checks it every night and I can hear her laughing from her bedroom. But at times, I don't know if she fully understands the jokes. But either way, she's really proud that we got to publish the book.
Serena Wu and Teresa Wu are not related, but they are both co-authors of My Mom is a Fob, a new book. The subtitle is Earnest Advice in Broken English from Your Asian American Mom. Teresa Wu joined us from our bureau in New York. Serena Wu joined us from San Francisco. And I thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you so much
for having us.
NPR's business news starts with the latest read on unemployment. The government comes out this morning with its new estimate of job growth. Most economists expect to see a boost in hiring during January. As NPR's John Itzty reports, the chairman of the Federal Reserve has also expressed some optimism about jobs.
Speaking at the National Press Club, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke again warned that it will be several years before the U.S. unemployment rate returns to normal levels. Right now, the rate is 9.4%, about twice what it was before the recession. But Bernanke said there are some positive signs.
Looking at the whole range of statistics on the labor market, the sense is that employers are becoming more willing to hire, and I think we'll start seeing some stronger payroll reports and some lower unemployment rates pretty soon.
Among those positive signs, lower initial claims for unemployment benefits. The latest report on initial claims, released yesterday, showed a steady downward trend continuing. One factor holding down job growth in this recovery has been growth in productivity, that is, an increase in the amount a firm can produce with the same number of workers. The efficiency gains have been so great that the U.S. was able to return to its pre-recession level of GDP with about 7 million fewer workers on the job. And yesterday, a new report showed productivity growth accelerating. But Bernanke says that with consumer and business demand growing, that can't last forever.
Now, firms are beginning to say, well, wait a minute, we're now seeing enough increase in our sales that, and we have, you know, already exhausted the obvious productivity gains, that it's time now to start bringing on new workers.
Economists are predicting that about 145,000 new jobs were added to business payrolls in January. That would be an improvement from December, when about 100,000 new jobs were added. Up to now, Bernanke says, anxiety among employers about the durability of the recovery has meant many firms would only hire workers on a temporary basis.
Because they can bring temporary workers on, and if the economy weakens again, they can let them go. It'll be a really good sign when we see those temporary jobs being converted into permanent jobs, and I'm hopeful that that's where we're going to be heading in the next couple of quarters.
While striking an optimistic tone, Bernanke also acknowledged continuing risks to the economic outlook. The unrest in the Middle East, for instance, has the potential to raise oil prices significantly and hurt consumers.
We're trying to stimulate the economy. We're trying to get consumers to become more confident, be able to spend more, and to help put people back to work. To the extent that part of their income gains are drained away by higher gas prices, for example, that's going to be a negative and it's going to slow the recovery.
There are other risks, too, including the prospect that state and local governments, struggling to balance their budgets, will cut their workforces sharply and swell unemployment lines. Boosting the rate of job growth is urgent, said Bernanke, because almost half of all unemployed Americans have been out of work for 6 months or more.
And what that means is that if they find work again in the future, it could very well be at a much reduced wage or at part-time. People who are not employed for long periods of time, they lose their skills, they lose their connections, they lose their knowledge of what's happening in their particular line of work. And so the consequences could last a very long time.
Bernanke says that to bring down unemployment, the economy must grow at a rate of more than 2.5% a year. Forecasts suggest the U.S. economy will grow between 3 and 4% this year. That would likely bring the unemployment rate down, but not very rapidly. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
Social networks like Facebook and Twitter are helping people stay connected, but some observers worry that social networks are reinforcing our divisions by letting us hang out online with people who are just like us. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Dwayne Aikens goes to Facebook to stay in touch with friends and family who, for the most part, share his political views. Aikens lives in Oakland, California, and runs a nonprofit that focuses on health and fitness. He's generally liberal.
A lot of my friends are Democrats and liberals. I haven't really seen no Tea Parties, and I haven't bumped into no Republicans.
And Facebook's software may be reinforcing his tendency to only see links from people he agrees with. When Facebook shows you your top news, it guesses what you'll like based on how often you click on a particular friend's entries. Dean Eccles, a PhD candidate at Stanford who studies social networks, says most people don't click on posts when they disagree.
Because I'm not sure I want to register my disagreement with somebody. That may just not seem appropriate or like a fun experience. And so a service like Facebook can't really know that you want to see that there if you never click on the content and you never comment on it.
Facebook keeps you in your own group. In some ways, Twitter does as well, but it may connect you with people who you don't know, but who enjoy, say, the same TV show. If you look at trending topics on Tuesday nights, you might see a hashtag for The Game. It's a show on BET about a group of black football players and their personal lives.
Finally got himself a woman that knows how to take care of a ball player.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you know what? I thought I had one of those. But she was all take and no care.
Dwayne Aikens watches and tweets about The Game. He loves the show because it gets beneath stereotypes of black football players.
The show gives it the opportunity to be spoken about and to be made real. And some of the issues on the show might start movements or something like that.
A Twitter movement is what has kept The Game on the air. In 2009, the CW network canceled it. Angry tweets went out from the black community, says Kira Gaunt, a professor at City College and a TED fellow who's African American. Gaunt says the Twitter conversation focused on how little good programming there was about black life, even on BET. Gaunt says BET saw the chatter and picked up The Game.
I think there's a little bit of wishful, hopeful thinking that something might turn a corner with the way that BET mediates images of black people. We don't want a black version of MTV.
Among African Americans, Twitter is extremely popular. According to a study by Edison Research, 25% of Twitter users are black. Craig Watkins, a communications professor at the University of Texas, says young African Americans use Twitter because so many of them have cell phones and use them to communicate with friends. He says it's also the main entryway to the internet for many low-income blacks who don't have home computers and broadband.
And so that mobile device becomes a very sort of reliable way
to do the kinds of things that they want to do online, if it's watching video, if it's updating their Facebook status, if it's using Twitter.
But even though there is a lot of conversation going on among African Americans on Twitter, Professor Gaunt says it's very different from the closed nature of Facebook because tweets are public.
It becomes about listening. Like, oh my God, I can listen in to what black people are talking about. Oh my God, they talk about that? Oh my God. And you can actually say something if you want.
When Gaunt realized people could talk back on Twitter, she decided to have conversations about race. She says it's been a really freeing experience because people are honest.
You can really have a conversation and not worry about getting punched in the nose. There's debate. There's engagement. There's learning about black people, even if you've never seen one before.
Gaunt says she's made new friends through Twitter.
I'm meeting strangers. I met with two people I had engaged with through Twitter in the past 10 days who I'd never met in real time, in what we say in IRL, in real life. And I met them, and I felt like, this is my tribe.
And Gaunt says they weren't black. But the key word for some observers is tribe. Although there are people like Gaunt who are using social media to reach out, some observers are concerned that she is the exception to the rule, that most of us will be content to stay within our race, class, ethnicity, family, or political party. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
States are trying to figure out how to protect colleges from mass shootings. And some lawmakers think one solution is to allow students and staff to arm themselves. Legislators in 8 states have proposed bills that would let people carry a concealed handgun into the lecture hall, the library, and the dorm. NPR's John Burnett has our story from Austin, Texas.
In most states that have a concealed carry law, premises of higher education are off limits. A bill in Texas would change that.
Right now, so-called gun-free zones, I think, ought to be renamed victim zones. I just don't want to see a repeat in Texas of what happened at Virginia Tech.
State Senator Jeff Wentworth, a San Antonio Republican, is sponsoring a bill that would allow handguns on campuses. He referred to the Virginia Tech massacre 4 years ago, where a student killed 32 people on campus before turning the gun on himself. Last September, the University of Texas at Austin had its own scare.
Wheeler police tell us Colton Tooley, a math major and sophomore at UT, is the gunman who fired shots outside before shooting himself.
Campus inside police were praised for their quick response when the 19-year-old, wearing a business suit and a ski mask, started shooting an assault weapon in the air, then ran into a library and committed suicide. He didn't shoot anyone else. According to Wentworth and other supporters of the law, a citizen with a handgun can possibly take out a campus shooter before police arrive.
Because when seconds count, the police are only minutes away.
Texas lawmakers rejected a bill allowing concealed carry on campus 2 years ago. Since then, Republicans have gained a supermajority in the legislature, and the controversial law has come back stronger than ever. With 50,000 students, the University of Texas at Austin is one of the biggest schools in the country. 2 years ago, the student government, faculty council, and President Bill Powers came out against the law to permit hidden pistols in university buildings. It's legal for license holders to carry on the campus grounds. Powers says his position has not changed.
Friday night comes on our campus once a week, mixing youth, handguns, and partying. Is, in my view, a mix for serious concerns about safety on campus.
We get the mature thing a lot, that college students are mature enough, and the alcohol thing, that we're all just boozed up all the time.
Corey Zipperer is a 21-year-old UT psychology major and a spokesman for the Longhorn chapter of Students for Concealed Carry on Campus. On a recent morning, he came down to the state capitol to lobby officials. As a license holder himself, Zipperer discreetly straps on a .38 special. In Texas, he points out, to get a concealed handgun license, you must be 21 years old, have a clean record and no psychiatric disorders, and take a 10-hour instruction course that includes time at a firing range.
So if people think that 21-year-olds are too immature to get a license, it sounds like they just have a problem with the whole concept.
When John Woods came to Austin for graduate school from Virginia Tech, he thought he left behind the rampage that killed two of his friends. When the Texas legislature took up guns on campuses, Woods, a 26-year-old biology grad student, stepped forward to become a leading voice opposing the bill.
People think of colleges as just being classrooms, but there's a lot more going on here. We have hospitals on campus. In some cases, there are preschools. Again, you have sensitive labs where there are hazardous materials. And this is also something where the legislature is taking away the higher education institutions' abilities to make any policy on the issue.
At a nearby table inside the student union, students Logan Healy and Bethany Ellerbrook totally agreed.
So our suggestion to stop people from bringing guns to campus is to allow other students to bring guns to campus so that we can have gunfights.
That's an awful idea. I hate it.
The Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence reports that 22 states have rejected similar legislation. One that did not is Utah, where the University of Utah in Salt Lake City has had a concealed weapon carry law for 5 years. Chase Jardine is president of the student body.
I'd say the vast majority of our student body doesn't even know about the law, or if someone does have a handgun in class, I bet you 95% of people would never know about it.
When asked his personal opinion, the student body president said he's indifferent. It's a non-issue on campus. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. On the Green Bay Packers roster this Sunday for the Super Bowl is nose tackle B.J. Raji. He's listed as 6'2", 337 pounds. The defensive lineman makes his living stopping running backs and putting pressure on quarterbacks. When he picked off a pass in the NFC Championship game and scored his first pro touchdown, Raji put his hands on his hips and gave those 300-plus pounds a shake. NPR's Mike Pesca went to the lineman's hometown of Westwood, New Jersey to find out where he got his moves.
One phrase often used to describe prototypical defensive linemen, specifically nose guards, is space eater. It's meant to convey awesome power, but not much dynamism. But in the NFC Championship game against the Bears, B.J. Raji ate up more than space. He devoured the football and then gobbled up the spotlight with a hip-shaking dance.
On third down and 5, pressure. Pass is picked off, and who is it? Big B.J. Raji for the touchdown.
The Fox announcers asked, what's B.J. Raji even doing there? It's an interesting journey. B.J. stands for Busari Jr. Busari Sr. came from Nigeria, by way of London, by way of France, seemingly furthering his education every step of the way, with degrees in engineering, followed by pharmacy, followed by mental health, and he's now getting his doctorate in divinity. He's a minister at his Harlem church 3 days a week and at nights.
I go to work every night, 11 to 7:30 in the morning every day. It doesn't bother me. You know, I don't sleep much.
Very few.
You heard there Mamie, BJ's mom, Busari's wife, and also Busari's boss, because Mamie is the bishop of the church where Busari is minister. Their personal flock began with an 8-pound, 5-ounce BJ who, from the time he could walk, ran.
We were afraid he would hurt himself because he was always running. Stop, you're going to fall. He never fell.
The family moved from Queens to Westwood, New Jersey when BJ was 8. His first love was basketball. In fact, the middle Busari boy, Corey, plays for Boston College. But soon someone saw the large and nimble BJ and directed him to the football field. Busari, who thought American football was overly violent, remembers that BJ struggled mightily to do calisthenics at his very first football practice.
And I just couldn't take that. I wanted to just go there and just pull him out. But as I was just about to go, somebody said, stop, look at other children. If they can do it, he can do it. So I pulled back, and I'm glad I did.
But by day two, literally day two, Busari says, BJ was showing aptitude for football. Very soon, he had established himself as the blend of size, speed, and determination that would characterize his game to this day. But the size part of that equation did trouble Busari, who's a svelte man of under 6 feet tall. Mamie is only 5'3".
I remember him when he was in junior high school, and his father was after him about losing weight. And I'll never forget, we were in the kitchen, and he was fixing some food. He said, Daddy, this weight is going to make me a millionaire.
And there's one more thing. The dance. The famous hip-shaking shimmy that BJ busted out in the Chicago end zone after his touchdown. It turns out that when BJ was 2 years old, he would get his grandmother to chase him.
Run through the dining room and up under the dining room table so fast when he'd stand there and do the same thing he did that night. Granny can't catch me.
Oh, if opponents only knew that BJ was teasing them like he teased his old granny. Well, if they knew, they probably wouldn't be able to stop him any better than they can now. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Dallas, Texas.